Friday, June 10th. Good afternoon, committee. We are going to carry over Senate Bill 863 until Monday. So we will open a work session on House Bill 3120.
Representative
Nolan and I yesterday met with the governor and his staff. While we're not going to go into detail as to exactly what happened, it is time for the committee to narrow its focus to the areas that we need to basically spend the next 2 days on, Monday and Tuesday. I'm expecting that we will have this bill completed by Tuesday night and hopefully have a public hearing on Wednesday with the new bill. The areas that I am proposing that this committee concentrate on are the claims process, judicial review, transferability, the aspects of Senate Bill 82, which consists of the review process of our land use system over the interim, separation of powers, the UGB fringe, and the compensation issue, which also would appear at this point to be going toward the interim and not to be a part of 3120, other than to be a part of the interim directive. Open for any discussion on those particular items. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I have a series of questions that I'm basically having typed up now, just falling a bit behind on my production, but I did touch upon claims, judicial review, transferability, and that's about it. So at least we might have something to take home over the week. And the frame that I used was the -3 replacement. I just anticipated that might be the closest vehicle we're going to use.
I would think that would be the first order of business, committee, in beginning the process, is to decide right now. 3120 is a bill holding county commissioners harmless from land use decision. Nothing has been voted on as far as the amendments into 3120. I would suspect that our first order of business should decide which set of amendments we want to insert into 3120 to begin the process with. In other words, to add and delete as we go through. And again, I'm leaving this open to discussion.
Well, seeming logically to start would be to amend 37 into it to begin. Because everything we do would be modifying something 37 and adding to it or something. Yeah. I mean, the blank slate,
I'm assuming, would be 37. You're saying
measure 37? Measure 37. I mean, it's sort of where you started with the advanced run amendment. You started by taking measure 37 and putting it in. It seemed to me the blank slate we would want would be to substitute measure 37 in that bill in its current form.
Be to substitute measure 37 for the bill in its current form, and then put pieces into 37 from the various amendments. That'd be the tabula rasa.
A different approach, but
at least it gives us a starting place.
Committee, have any feelings?
I haven't had time to think about that very much, but I have no problems putting the language from ballot measure 37 as a starting point in a bill. So I just think we are then.
It is a starting point for the -1 amendments currently.
And also the 3.
And for the -3 amendments.
Okay.
So what both of those amendments did was they took the rules of 37 and changed or added or did things to both of them. So, I mean, it seemed to me that would just give us a way to follow through by saying, okay, here's what the dash ones did to this section of 37. Here's what the dash threes did to it. Do we want one or the other of those, or do we want something else? But it would give us simply the, basically the scorecard.
Are you saying then that we delete, as we go, delete measure 37 and include the dash 3 or dash 7? Or?
Well, I don't think 37 was deleted in either the dash 1s or the dash 3s. It was, or the dash 4s, for that matter. They just said, okay, when we get to this section of 37, do X. And the other one said, do Y. And the third one said, do Z. Or didn't say anything about that section. And it would just allow us, as we're going through with the amendments, to say, okay, here's the first place the dash 1s change it, or the dash 3s change it. Is that a change we want put in? And create an omnibus amendment that will go from there. But either starting from the dash 1s or the dash 3s, there's just some stuff in both of them that I think.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, I've looked back through the various amendments I have, and I think all of them start with inserting the language of Measure 37 into I think it's 197, ORS 197. So I don't think that that should be a controversial proposal, and it creates a framework for deciding what elements on your checklist or how to address the elements on your checklist.
Any other discussion? I'm just worried, I'm just thinking, are we reinventing the wheel there? If we started there and made those changes, I go back and consider them again.
Well, if it was just a matter of saying let's accept or reject the dash ones or accept or reject the dash threes, then that wouldn't be the answer. The answer would be to put the dash threes in, say. But my sense is that's not where we are. My sense is we're going to be picking or choosing from among them, deleting some, adding some, picking some out of one versus the other. But, I mean, it really doesn't matter. We could use the threes just as well. It is basically the same thing, but it just prejudges a bunch of things when we start with one of the existing ones rather than leaving it as an open slate.
Mr. Chair, given that you have told this committee we have 2 days to do this work, I think we need to have a place to start. And even if that means we reject substantial portions of one of the amendments, we at least have a basis for starting. If we try to do this from a truly blank slate, I question even this capable committee's ability to do that.
And that kind of reflects my feelings coming into this, was that we could take either the dash ones or the dash threes, and then we have a basis to go forward on from that. Director Shetterly, would you join us, please?
Bring your coin up here, Director.
I'm in either of those.
Your background as a legislator and now your experience as director of this agency, would you have any words of wisdom for the committee in this regard?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Wayne Shetterly, director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Okay, it's taken up that much time. I guess
when Mr. Indy just left the room, by the way,
he's probably going to call my wife to call me or something. I guess I would concur with Representative Nolan, given the time frame that you've established for yourself, that what you have before you are some amendments that at least provide a template, and I would commend to you another template, recognizing the committee, very well the committee goes, but the dash threes, as amended that would refer you the other way are also, I think, reasonable place, in that they represent at least the product of substantial discussion, if not agreement yet, among several players. You're more likely to find at least the seeds of a consensus, I believe, in working from an amendment like that as a place to begin your deliberations. I hope that's helpful.
Do we have a formal version of that, or is this the latest thing we have?
That's the latest thing. I think talking to John Chandler just before the meeting, they are struggling to get you something by sometime Monday, is what he indicated.
John, why don't you come on up, please? Lynch, Director Shetterly is
here.
He's lonely, man. Lonely.
Yeah. Oh, my phone.
Do we have anything other than the amendments to the amendments in the dash threes?
We might have one, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Homeowners Association. We might have an extra amendment thing about. I think we're on the. Yeah, we will. But we're trying to get that all pulled together in time to get it to Mr. Conway, in time to get it to you. It's fine tunings, nothing.
So if we started with the dash threes today.
Mr. Chair, if I may, since what you're doing is largely conceptual anyway, if there's really no harm in using the conceptual amendment as a starting point.
That's correct.
Because at this point, whatever you're doing is conceptual.
Yeah, and you were here for a reason. Wait a minute.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Given that you, Mr. Chandler, have said you're still working on fine-tuning the dash three, can we take that fine-tuning to mean, as Mr. Shetterly has suggested, that for purposes of a walkthrough on this idea, this concept stays in, this concept goes out, the dash three would be an adequate outline to work from, and the amendments you're working on tweaking would still be germane after we complete that list of in or out
decisions.
The chairman of the one, yes. Mr. Chair, I think if you're talking about basically the dash threes as rewritten and presented to you a few days ago as a menu, if you would, yes. I think that probably is a useful tool.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for getting the committee's discussion on that would be helpful in terms of further refinement of the language, because if there's things in there that you all think are dumb, then there's no point refining those. And anything you are interested in pursuing or elaborating on or adding to or subtracting from, this, as you all know, this is a very complicated subject, and the language, every word gets fought over, so those kind of a conceptual discussion would be very helpful.
I think we're going to try and simplify that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got kids in college, Mr. Chairman. Don't simplify it too much.
Are we talking about starting with this document, which strikes me as a confusing document rather than a simplifying one? Now, I don't know what's being struck and added as I read through this. Is that just me?
One dated June 8th.
Yeah.
The one dated June
8th.
The House Bill
3126
replaces the dash
threes. Mr. Chair, I think that is a complete document. Yeah, I think it is a complete document. I don't think it. I think it is all there. I don't think you need to. If you're looking at that as the template, you don't need to be looking at that and at another set of amendments somewhere else to try and pull in the elements. It's there.
This is 25 pages long, right?
But these aren't amendments to the dash threes. These are.
The dash threes.
The dash
threes. We can work with that. We're replacing the dash threes.
It would be an amendment to the House bill. It would be a self-contained amendment to the House bill.
Yes. On the other hand, committee, we do have the LC draft 2975, which is the dash three amendments dated 6-6, which might be in a little better form for us to go through. The
original dash treaty.
The original dash treaty, LC-2975, dated 6-6, that were presented to us earlier this week. That's in an actual amendment form by section that might make it easier to for the committee to begin with.
Well, I would like to point out that I think it's their intent that this document of June 8th would replace that original dash 3, so this replacement dash 3, I think their intent would be to just disregard the previous submitted material, if I understand this correctly.
Mr. Chair, yeah, you can, of course, it's your committee, your menu. Comparing the LC form of the dash 3s with the rewritten version of the dash 3s that were presented to you 2 days ago, I would say the rewritten version is more refined in terms of language and concept. And so, again, if you're trying to start a little bit farther out ahead, just in thought on these issues, I think those rewritten versions of the dash 3s will probably start you out ahead. John and I are trying to remember what's in the dash 3s, and yeah. That reflects that it's been at least a week ago, and so neither of us really remember.
The VLC version.
The VLC version, yeah.
What we've done, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, as we continue to play with the concepts and add and subtract words here and there, we've moved off of the conceptual, if you will, amendments, not the LC version, because we had those in word and format. We could circulate them by email. We could work on them at home in the evenings. It's harder to do that with an LC draft. I don't think there's anything in the LC draft that isn't in the conceptual, but the later versions of the conceptual are going to be later versions of what will ultimately be in the LC draft, should you choose to go that way, if that makes sense. As good as I can do if it doesn't. Big brother?
Nothing makes sense.
It is. That's, yes.
You do.
We are in land use committee after all.
Track the way.
Sense is optional.
Well, it would appear then that the amendments to the dash 3 amendments would be the best place to start.
This one. They have consensus on that.
Yeah, they have. Yeah.
They have achieved consensus.
Oh, yes. All we're lacking is votes, Representative
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, sir. I haven't read all of these, but I did read the dash 3 replacement. It has, I think, every conceivable issue there for us to resolve.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It has every conceivable issue. It's a long text, and I think it's a good template to start for that reason.
I think that's what you said.
Yeah, I believe it is your most complete reading of the next 3 years.
Is that the edition dated June 8th?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
The assertion that this is a listing of the universe that might possibly be considered raises the question of whether we want to start with the universe and whittle down, or start with a core and add up. Sometimes it's easier to add than to delete. And I just throw that to the good chair in terms of process, given your self-imposed time limit.
The time limit is not self-imposed.
Okay. Even more so then.
The process that I envisioned was to, in this case now, adopt the amendments to the dash 3 amendments, go through and delete by section those sections that we will not be considering as part of the clarifying of Measure 27. And then, okay, going through the amendments that the committee has received to add those amendments or create the amendments we need to make the bill complete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's open to the committee's...
I have a question about that. On page... are these pages numbered? I hope they are. Yeah, on page 2... That item 5, this is a process question. So that if we decide that on 5A, those points in the middle of page 2, if we decide we don't want to include those, then what's struck out here would be put back in. Is that right? That's what's in the original Measure 37. Is that?
Mr. Chair, that was in agreement. That is correct. On page 2, I think your first, four pages restate the text of ballot Measure 37. And so language shown as stripping would be language that was originally in ballot Measure 37 and is proposed to be stricken. Language that is underlined is language that would be, that is proposed under these amendments to be inserted into ballot Measure 37.
This one would be bolded in the ordinary, form, and the other
that's
would,
correct.
Be,
that's correct.
Would be italic. So in going through this, we say, okay, this is fine. Believe us, we say, no, we want the original, then we just know we strike the one section and the other one comes back.
Mr. Klein, would you join the panel, please?
And did you say this is not only is true on page 4, through page 4, the rest are all additions?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood. The original text of ballot measure 37 ends with subsection 13 that's shown on page 4. Text.
Sections 3 through 18.
That's correct.
Yes, are added.
Yeah.
That does make it easy to handle.
3 through 26 or 27 are added.
So we either add those or we don't add them. Mm-hmm. Or we add something else.
What would the process be for making additions or deletions?
The process would be just going forward.
How would the committee decide if one person says, I don't like that part?
Consensus, then we'll have to take a vote. Okay. The committee agree to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, although I hope the committee is open to discussing the pieces of what will essentially become the bill, I believe you said, not exclusively as standalone pieces, because I think many of the pieces relate to each other. And so we may go through a section and say, if this section stays in, this section has to stay in. If this section comes out, this section comes out, that there will be some nexus across the different elements of it, rather than strictly going through section by section and having each one have to stand independently. Because I think we've heard in testimony earlier this week that the group that developed this did a very careful weighing of the issues and made some nexus among some of the pieces, and has said that some of their members, some of the people working on this, liked one element and didn't like an element, but on balance they thought it was a fair combination. And I think we need to be mindful of that as we go through it as well.
I would also say I could live with this section if this other section was not there. I mean, I can imagine that kind of, I mean, any of those kinds of arguments that linked
right.
In the discussion.
I think all of that is good dialogue, and that we're kind of making our own rules as we go along, which is kind of fun. I think we can get the job done.
It's a good place.
So
you got consensus on this one.
Ms. Klein, any comment?
No, Mr. Chair, other than to concur and amplify a little bit on what Representative Nolan said, not only in terms of the work group where some sections, some people would give on one side if something else happened on the other, but there are a number of sections that are cross-referenced to each other. And so the ideas or the concept embodied in one section, in a sense, really relies in part for some of them on other sections. And so as you go through, if you just cut out one section, you might leave another section, in a sense, incomplete, and be happy to assist the committee as you go through to let you know where that would come up.
And that was the next question, that the committee was assuming that you are the main drafter.
I was one of several people who had worked on this, but of the people that are in this room today, I know more about this than I think the other folks.
then, and you're available to be right here with this committee through the next, through Monday and Tuesday?
Yes, Mr. Chair. As long as I'm back in Eugene by 5:30 for a city council meeting on Monday.
Yeah, you might have a little problem with that Monday night, but we appreciate that very much.
Be happy to do it.
All right, committee. I guess we will start, unless I hear an objection, we will start with the Dash 3 amendments to the Dash 3.
Okay. Sure, we may well retire, but certainly be available on us.
The doors, please.
Suggested that some of us draft some amendments, and I think probably by Monday, I have one amendment to consider, but that would be a logical thing to consider after we've gone through this whole thing, and then
correct.
Say, okay, now, there's also, how about this?
And any committee member has the right to offer to the committee amendments to what we're doing. And then it will be up to the committee to either accept or not. And again, if we can't find a general agreement on something, then we will put it to a vote and move forward in that respect. The chair will be specifically reminding the committee to focus on the area of clarifying Measure 37. That is what we are going to do and nothing more.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned 2, 4, 6, 7 components. It might be helpful if we knew which of the sections of this in advance dealt specifically with areas of, say, claims processing area. I mean, that might be a little guidance for us.
The chair has a little bit of it.
You've got a list of that.
Yeah, and we pretty well know that the Dash 3s, and we'll just call them the Dash 3s at this point, basically has a claims process and judicial review that pretty well are not objected to.
That's in this document, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That can't be at that way,
right.
Where that's at.
I'm going to open this up to the people in this room who are the principals involved with this, that as we're going along, if you wish to make a comment about a move that we're making, I want you to know that we will listen to you as long as you're brief. That's what we're trying to do, and that's why we haven't made up a list of people who are, you know, the invited testimony. You're here because you're interested, and because you're interested, then we're interested if you have a strong opinion on something that we're looking at or you feel the committee needs to know. Okay? So just bring that to the chair's attention, and we'll try to get on with it. All right? So let's move to the Dash 3, Section 1. Mr. Klein, maybe it would be best if you'd give us the overview on Section 1, so the committee can first decide as to whether this is applicable to clarifying Measure 37 or changing Measure 37.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. What Section 1 does is to use the old language of Measure 37 and makes a couple changes to it that the work group thought were non-controversial. And that Section 1 would only apply to certain claims. And so what we attempted to do is say claims filed by a certain date, and in here it was March 15th, those claims could continue to be processed under, in essence, existing Measure 37, and then the balance of the bill is, in a sense, new claims that would be filed. But what we also decided is that under existing Measure 37, it would help to make a couple changes to that that would help the process and not disadvantage anybody. What the changes are, on page 2, the changes in subsection 5 simply create that March 15th date and says if what you want to do is go under old Measure 37, subsection 5A says, well, you have to have filed before March 15th. That's the intent of the changes on subsection 5.
Okay, let me interrupt just for a second. This committee is representing the legislature. We're going to have to sell this to both sides of this body. Why is this section here? Why do we need a new 37 and an old 37? Why are we even going here?
Mr. Chair, the reason for differentiating is because in order to have the claims process, to have what we thought was a reasonable claims process be available and apply to Measure 37 claims, is we needed people to, in a sense, refile those claims. But what we also thought, and what we had heard from others, is that it would be unfair to have those people who particularly filed before there was any indication that there would be a Measure 37 rewrite. And the time that Senator Ringo first started publicly talking about his rewrite was the middle of March, which is why this middle of the March 15th date is there. We thought it would be unfair to say, you have to start over. So what we did was to say, you can, if you want, if you file before March 15th, you can continue to process your claim under the old measure, but then you're not going to get the advantages of the new measure, which is the clarification on transferability and use and some of those things. So that's why there's this differentiation between those claims that have already been filed and have been either completely processed or are substantially processed. We wanted to give those people the opportunity to continue to have their claims processed under the old measure, but in addition to give them the option of withdrawing their claims and filing under the new measure, where there'd be a clarified claims process, judicial review, transferability, and those provisions.
At this point, though, we don't know whether there's going to be any discrimination between prior to March 15th and post-March 15th, because we haven't decided what we're going to do yet. So therefore, I would, follow me, committee, correct me, stop me if I'm, therefore I think addressing Section 1 at this point is premature.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly concur in that it would be much easier, at least for me, to advise you as to what I think you might want to do with Section 1 once you work through the rest of the bill.
Thank you. Yeah. Don't hesitate to just tell us that right at the beginning.
But even then, Mr. Chair, it seems to me March 15th is an artificial date. If we do have a new and an old process, it seems to me the proper date would be the effective date of the bill.
Yeah. Next Tuesday or whatever.
Well, no. The formal effective date of the bill, which would be when it's signed or something.
After the signature.
And it seems to me that would be a true, if there is to be a new way and an old way, it would seem to me that would be the proper date for the new way and the old way.
And committee, I have to apologize to you, because I started in on this process forgetting that Mr. Schellenberg was here with -6 amendments, and now he's left the room. So, Sam, would you go? Art's going to see if he can find him. That it would be fair. The committee needs to hear his presentation on the -6s before we really started this process. So
I have a question on Section 1.
Representative?
I just wanted to know a clarification. Is this, you can file either or does it become, this is...
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the way it's drafted is that if your claim was filed after March 15th, you would have to refile it under the new measure. If your claim was filed prior to March 15th, it would be your option to decide whether you want to withdraw it and refile it.
So all the charges you incurred in the meantime would be just gone. You'd have to withdraw it, and hopefully that was covered under the new one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, this doesn't speak to that issue of whether you would have to pay a new filing fee if you had paid an old one.
Don, I apologize. We got started on this thing because we're a little anxious. You have submitted to the committee -6 amendments, and we'd like to have you, if you will, go through those -6 amendments with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schellenberg, representing the Northern Farm Bureau. You have the -6 in front of you. You also have a rough draft of the dash 6, dated 6-7, and I've made some markings on that. What's important about that is not is everything but the, is the last page. And the last page of that is a description of the different ORSs that I'll refer to in just a moment. So just keep that in mind, that that's why you have that document. What I've done here, I viewed what the chair did with 3120-1 as being the amendments to 1037-2, actually, a white version of that, I guess you'd say. And I took the chair's 3120-1 and did a white version of that. And then hastened to say that the dash 3s do not represent the entire universe, as was suggested. It's a good part of it, granted. But there are a couple other things that I'd like to suggest as part of the dash 6 amendments. And I'll just try to go through that quickly on page 2, line 24 through line 5 on page 3. This is a section of Measure 37 that deals with what you can't file a Measure 37 claim on. And we think it's important to add these references, and that's the ones I referred to in that other document. They're all listed there, and they basically have to do some of it. For instance, you can't file a Measure 37 based on right to farm law. More basically on water laws. We don't want to be doing damage to our state water laws either. The others refer to administrative rules and statutes that the Department of Agriculture enforces. And those are things that protect agriculture and its commodities. We don't want inadvertent Measure 37 claims filed on those issues.
Don, what's an inadvertent Measure 37 claim?
No, I mean inadvertent claims. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Didn't mean Measure 37 was inadvertent.
So just a little sensitive there.
Then moving to page 5, lines 8, 9, 10, and 11. As I think I indicated earlier, we are not comfortable with transferability, at least unlimited transferability, that is, and so removed, I believe it was 9 and, or 10 and 11 in 3120-1, and instead inserted here that transferability would allow you to transfer that right to a family member, and they would retain the right to do whatever was allowed under the Measure 37 claim. Then, left everything else the same till you get over to page 13.
The same as the dash ones.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Neal, thank you. Page 13, you won't see a change there. What I'll tell you is what we did delete is the agency's ability to waive statute. And so that's not in there. So that's a change, but not one that you would notice if you weren't looking for it.
And why did you do that?
Mr. Chair, this is a separation of powers issue, and we were interested in preserving the separation of powers. We believe that 3120, 1037, whichever one you want to reference to, we believe that's an issue that shouldn't be in there, and so my suggestion is we remove that in order to preserve the separation of powers.
What was it that you took out? What was it that isn't there?
Where are we?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it's separation of powers. It would be, and I'm not sure of the page number in 3120, but in the dash sixes, it would be in the area of lines 7 and 8 on page 13.
Okay.
It would be in that area where it was located before.
You took it out?
Yes. At least that's our suggestion. Then on page 17, some new language we would add there. And this is actual language that we have proposed as House Bill 3349. Which passed your body 57-0, and this is the one that preserves automatic funds assessment if a Measure 37 claim would disqualify the zone from automatic funds assessment. That would prevent, yes, the one Representative Nolan carried on the floor, yes, it would simply prevent farmers from having to do extra paperwork by filing an application every year. On that same page,
I understand your issues.
It includes section 12 on line 17 through 30. Well, actually 17 through 13 on the next page, but whole section 12. I think that was a mistake on the part of legislative council. I don't know if there's any reason for that section 12 to be in there, and so I would suggest that it be deleted.
Sorry, what did you delete?
Section 12 on page 17, beginning on page 17. What is also deleted then?
I'm not following you. This is on your dash 6 amendments?
On our dash 6 amendments, we would like to delete section 12.
This section that's here now?
Yes.
Section 12?
Yes.
But you don't show that you want
to. No, no. That's why I say I asked for that to be deleted, but it wasn't. But I want to make a point that it should be, because it's part of all the other language relating to farm use assessment that was deleted from this, and that was in the dash 1s. It was quite a lengthy section dealing with farm use assessment. And it's our opinion that none of that needs to be in there, including this section.
And line 1 through 13 on page 18?
Correct. Then adding on page 18, section 14, and section 16, well, actually 15, but 15 is just some instructional language. This is one that was in 10.732 that we thought was of value. And that prohibits residential construction that would use more than 500 gallons a day of water. We have water quantity limited areas in this state, in the rural areas, and Measure 37 ostensibly would allow some level of development, whether it's individual dwellings or whether it's multiple dwellings, and that draw has the ability, certainly in water quantity limited areas, others can't site dwellings there now. We want to be very careful about that, and this would put that kind of limit on it. So if they use more, if it would use more than 500 gallons per day, that it wouldn't be allowed to be sited.
A, section 16 says city. The governing body of a city. Is that the only governing body you're concerned with?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it does include, yes. Section 14 deals with county approvals. Section 16 deals with city approvals. I don't know that we need section 16. I don't know that I asked for that, but it got put in there. Because they were hooked together in 1037. So it wouldn't hurt our feelings if it was not there. And that would be all the changes that we would suggest to the dash ones, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're saying that an area is limited in groundwater now, was it not also limited in groundwater then? Has there been a change, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it may not have been limited then.
If it was not then and is now, the building that's gone on since these people were probably first in line, they've had their water taken away from them. Now they're coming in and you're saying they can't build.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we wouldn't be so concerned about individual single-family dwellings. We would be more concerned about multiple dwelling issue if there were a housing development, for instance, rather than a single-family dwelling. So if that were altered to reflect that, that would be
creating another 37 claim. By saying, hey, you can't use 500 gallons, and the owner comes back and says, but I could, prior to you telling me I can't.
Mr. Chairman, I'll let my lawyer answer that question. Where is he at?
Is he here?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you may be right. I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair, whether that's, I mean, that may be the case.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Sir, you talk about changing the dash ones at the beginning and then at the end, and there's a whole section in the middle that you don't. Since we're not starting with the dash ones, are there some of those pieces that are particularly important to you that are in the current dash ones that you haven't deleted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, my sense is we took the dash ones and made them look like we thought they ought to look. So if it's not in here, we didn't think it was important, and we put the things in we thought were important.
No, I'm not asking that. You had changes up to about page 5, as I remember, and then no changes until page 18. Are there things in, since we're not starting with dash ones, we're starting with dash threes, are there things in those middle pages that you consider particularly important to stay in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, particularly claims and judicial review, well, I think those are the two key areas. We don't have any comment on those. We think they're fine the way they are. If there are changes to those sections, we'll have to evaluate that as it goes along. I'm not saying that there is anything particularly important in those that we would feel like we had to have. But we think what's there is fine.
Yes. You're right.
Did I answer your question?
Well, not quite, because we're not starting with dash ones. We're talking about starting with a dash three that may not have some of the things in it that there are in this document.
Okay.
So I wondered whether the things that you haven't talked about, are there any in there that you say, oh, this really needs to stay in from our perspective?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, I guess I would have to say I haven't studied the dash threes close enough and compared them with the dash ones that I could tell you that for sure. I know our people were interested in whether or not there were going to be public hearings, whether or not a neighbor could file suit against another neighbor charging a major 37 claim because they had a major 37 claim that reduced the value of their property. Those kinds of things were talked about. So I'll conclude my comments at that point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions, Mr. Schellenberg? Okay, see, thank you, Don.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
And you'll be available Monday and Tuesday.
Yes, sir.
And before we go back to the dash three, I guess I should ask officially, because I pretty well want to put an end to this, is there anyone else who has prospective amendments to 3120 they would like to present to the committee?
Not counting committee members.
Not counting committee members. Okay.
Good timing.
Okay, very good. Let's return then, committee, to the dash threes at this point. And what we have accomplished so far is basically eliminating, for the present, section one. Are we in agreement?
We're putting it at the end of our discussion.
Putting it, yeah. To say eliminating for the time being.
Yeah, the question being, if we create a second version of Measure 37, do we want to leave room for people to have applied under the first version or the second version?
Correct.
Right.
And then the question is, what date would we use for that?
So we'll move to section two.
Do you want Mr. Klein to return?
Mr. Klein, would you, yeah. I could get you a... All right, committee, and as we were advised earlier, don't tell us what exactly, because section two is one line, basically.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Glenn Klein with Harang Long. Section 2 is just intended to say that the balance of this gets added to Chapter 197. That's all it would do. And again, that's more technical in nature that Legislative Council would do or not do anyway.
Is it your feeling that Section 2 should be in the new bill that we're constructing?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The work group believed that Chapter 197 would be a good place for these provisions to be located since they are related to land use. And that's all this would do is just say where the provisions would go in the Oregon Revised Statutes.
Okay. So, committee, I'm assuming that leaving... Go ahead, Representative.
Where is the rest of the Measure 37 language currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlet, the Measure 37 has, and if you look on page 1, right under the section 1, it says the following provisions are added to and made a part of ORS Chapter 197.
So it's the same place.
That's where they are. Right.
Okay.
So now we move to section 3. Again, Glenn, give us your
no changes.
Mr. Chair, what Section 3 would do is to revise the definitions that are contained in Measure 37 itself. They were intended to clarify, to answer some of the ambiguities, some of the questions that were raised as to what Measure 37 means.
Then we need to be discussing it. So let's...
And we need the original feature.
Right.
Thank you. I was in Section 3.1A, was that the sum total of the definition of family or family member? Was step-parent, step-child, son-in-law, father-in-law, were they all included?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they are all included. Mm-hmm. Also included is B, and then what you see with respect to C and D were, I believe, implicit in Measure 37. To a certain extent, they were explicit. It talks about a legal entity owned by one or more family members. That's already in Measure 37. This language was just intended to spell it out a little more clearly.
My question was, it's not just bloodline, it's marriage line, essentially.
That
is married into or become part of the family.
That is correct. That's the way Measure 37 is already written, and the work group didn't propose to change that.
Well, Section 11A of Measure 37 defines a family member. The question is, how does this definition differ from...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, the definition isn't intended to be substantively different. On page 4, at the bottom of page 4, the top of page 5, the subsection C and subsection D are broken out, whereas in Measure 37 itself, in 11A, and this is at the top of page 4, it says a legal entity owned by any one or combination of these family members. Individuals who know a lot more about corporate law than I do suggested that to make it clear, C and D should be identified separately.
But in the 11A of Measure 37, what's 1A and B are exactly the same. Is that, that's what I was asking, as Measure 37?
I believe that's correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Is.
At least that's the intention at this point.
Yes.
And C and D are an explication of the end of 11A in the Measure 37.
That's correct.
Chairman Lifts writes.
Mr. Chair, this might be a good time for me to add that the June 8th version that we discussed with the committee 2 days ago is actually not the most current version that we have. We have continued to work on some of those issues as well as some clarifications. Some of those are real technical in nature. For example, with the definition of business entity, someone said, well, wait, what about a combination between a natural person and a business entity? And so in our latest version that is still just circulating in the work group, we have an additional paragraph E that says something like, or a combination of thereof. So there are some things in here that we have already suggested need slight tweaking. And I don't think I'll be able to go through each of those, but I did want to let you know that in the past 2 days, we have continued to try to improve this. Yesterday, I received a call from the court administrator's office saying, with respect to the judicial review provisions, there's some tweaks that they think need to be made to clarify things, not change them substantively. And so we've tried to incorporate some of that in our even newer version that, again, is still circulating among the work group to try to decide, does everybody agree that these all make sense?
Don't let it circulate too long. When would you think those documents would be available to the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would expect that certainly by Monday morning they could be available.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. We're up here in the back.
Yes, I raised this point before that the definition of a family member, although including business entities and the estate of a family member, does not include a trust in which family members would be either trustor or beneficiaries. I would think that that would, since that's a pretty viable interest entity these days, that this would be the place to insert some definition of a trust as a family member.
I think it's a good point for that discussion. Is part of the ambiguity of 37 that's left a lot of people kind of up in the air is family trusts, LLCs that were created amongst families, but in essence maybe have only been transferred or whatever within the past several years or outside of the Measure 37 claim. Am I the same place as you are?
Yes.
How can we, is it the intent of the committee to allow those people to have a 37 claim?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, before I can answer that question,
right.
I'd actually like to understand if we're trying to implement Measure 37, I'd like to understand what the effect of the language in C and D are, that those are changed from the language in the measure itself. Can you give us examples of ownership structures that you believe under the original language would be included, but under this language would not be included? And similarly, can you give us an example of an ownership structure that under the original language would not have been included, but under this language would be included?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I cannot. Again, this is outside of my area of expertise. I'm not sure
if Lane is still here.
His phone rang.
Oh, just in time. We certainly can get you that information for Monday if that would be okay. This is a part that somebody else worked on, and so I believe Lane might be able to do that. We certainly could tell you in terms of, or Lane could tell you in terms of claims that have been filed with the department, how that would play out. Mm-hmm. And so we could give you some specifics. I'm just not capable of doing it.
Mr. Chair.
And so if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, and not so much a question, but in response to your question, I can't answer your question until I know that information and I see it in the context of the totality of the bill. Because if we're talking about expanding the people who are eligible beyond those that the measure itself included, then I would like to see how that fits in the rest of the bill, because if we're implementing Measure 37, it's one thing. If we're expanding it to more groups than were originally eligible, that changes the flavor of it for me.
I think that's exactly the question.
Yeah.
Are we clarifying or are we changing? You're absolutely right. If we're changing, we're not going to go there. If we're clarifying, then that is an area that we need to go to.
Mr. Chair, yes. I may be getting a little brain dead because it's Friday afternoon at 2:30, but you might help me with one of the examples of a family member is a business wholly owned by the owner. How is that a family member? A business entity wholly owned by the owner? All business entities are wholly owned by their owners.
This would be, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, this would be a business entity that is wholly owned by that one person, as opposed to lots of businesses are owned by, my law firm, for example, is owned by 14 different shareholders. I don't wholly own it.
That's the definition of a family member? A family member is a business entity wholly owned by an owner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, Measure 37 currently defines family member to include a legal entity owned by anyone or combination of these family members or the owner of the property. And so what we were trying to do is simply clarify that some more in our language.
I think standing alone, it unclarifies it rather than clarifies it. I mean, it would seem to me the language you just said is better than having these sitting there all alone as a definition of a family member. Again, might make more sense to me on Monday morning.
Mr. Chair, just Representative Gard, not having heard the question that instigated this, I guess what's confusing is if you read a business entity wholly owned by the owner, you have to look back at there's another definition of owner.
No, this is a definition of family member.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, sometimes you create an LLC with two family members, one of which can own the entire LLC. The other one can be a listed member but not own it.
Well, it's the owner that's the issue. Rather, I mean, it seems to me the language you just quoted out of the Measure 37, a legal entity owned by any one of a combination of these family members or the owner of the property. That I understand, but this one simply doesn't make any sense to me in this context.
Mr. Chair, this might be a good opportunity for me to take you up on your offer to have me tell you when it would be good to postpone. This would be good to postpone until we can think a little bit more about it and then get back to the committee Monday morning.
If you have a white handkerchief, you can tie it to a pencil. Just wave it, Glenn, and we'll know. Okay, then let's mark that one for Monday to come back to. But we'll advise everybody we can't keep doing this or we'll never finish. So,
Mr. Chair, to follow up on Representative Ackerman's question on the LLC and the family trust, I think you could go in Section 3, B, in a state of a family member, and somehow you could put the language in there.
I don't see it's ambiguous in the original language. It talks about a legal entity owned by any one or a combination of these. An LLC is a legal entity. A trust is a legal entity. I mean,
I'm just not sure what.
I'm not in the county.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why. I don't know what the problem is in the original language.
There's been a real problem with proving ownership.
I suppose you don't own it. Well, you do own a trust. Somebody owns a trust.
Property is conveyed into the trust. The trust is the owner. But a trust may not be strictly a business entity.
Legal. It doesn't say business entity.
Excuse me, John.
At the original language.
Aren't they using the date to prove ownership is why this is a problem? I mean, they're saying that you changed your trust or your ownership to a LLC in 1999 when you've actually owned it since 1950, mm-hmm. and you're going by that date. I think that's the problem we're trying to address.
Sir, I'm looking at the original text of Measure 37, and it defines owner is the present owner of the property or any interest therein. That would cover the businesses, LLCs, etc.
Mm-hmm. I disagree.
Well, I think the language added is just clarification of interest therein.
I think interest therein refers to the quality of title that you have. You have a fee title, or do you hold a leasehold interest? Do you hold an easement? I think that's what any interest therein means.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we use that word interchangeably with some other concepts, but it is something we'll have to bear down on later on as that comes up. That's my...
See, I'm making notes what that'll be.
Yes, the question as to why we have different definitions in different sections. Why don't we consolidate all of those for the whole bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, going back to the comments I made when I first got up here half hour ago, what we tried to do with Measure 37 itself, where it was going to apply to existing claims, is to make as few changes as possible, not really clarify things other than to say, here's the cutoff date that we came up with, and the other provision that we put in there was, here's how we're going to deal with judicial review for those claims, and let's expressly grant the state agency the authority to waive claims so that the legislature didn't have to deal with those. That's all we tried to do for old Measure 37. The reason why we have the new definitions is, in essence, for the rest of the bill. So the old definitions would only apply to the old claims. Because, in fact, one of the next definitions that you get to, land use regulation, is defined differently than old Measure 37.
Right. So it would have got to be kept separate.
Correct. I'm getting back to my trust entity again. You know, if we believe that the trust entity is implicit within the definition of a business entity or a business entity owned by the owner, why not set forth what we mean? I agree.
Yeah.
We need some language, of course, to do that, but I'm not that going to be that strict with construction as to say if it's, you know, implicit, we're not going to write it out.
And, Mr. Chair, that's why I asked the question of examples of entities that would be included under one set of words and not under another. If there are none, then I think we're on the safest ground to stay with the original language because we know that that's what the voters approved. But if there are examples, then I think the committee needs to weigh whether we want to do that. But if we think it's included, am I around with the...
Yeah. We can do that, Representative Nolan, if we can come back to you on Monday with that information.
That would be perfect.
Okay. Are there other questions on Section 3?
I think I had a couple, Mr. Chair. Page 5. I guess the pages aren't numbered, but just sub 3 there. Defining owner, and I'm getting into the definition of a land sale contract where you say the owner is the legal owner of food record title, that's no problem. Or if notarized, a land sale contract, or if a notarized land sale contract is enforced. Why the word notarized? Could there be some documents out there that may not be notarized and would thereby fail 37 claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think that was another area that was still undergoing some clarification there. The idea is that we have seen already claims based on unrecorded land sales contracts, and the sense was that currently under Oregon law, a purchaser under a land sales contract is actually required to file a memorandum of the contract or the contract for recording within 15 days of the date of the contract. That establishes that purchaser's interest in the property. Recognizing that that doesn't always happen, but also wanting some assurance that the document is a valid document as of the date, because the date is critical. The sense here was that if it's an unrecorded land sales contract, then a notarized contract should suffice. Mm-hmm. Although I think that you do raise an issue that would probably be worth addressing in this, in that land sales contracts are not always notarized, and what you would have would be a notarized memorandum of the contract that's recorded that should suffice. And so that is easy to clarify.
That was going to take me to my next point, because you require other owners, a title of record, and you say, or a land sale contract that is in force. We don't record land sale contracts, but you record a memorandum thereof, as Director Shirley suggests. And I think you should, therefore, modify that to say a land sale contract that has been recorded pursuant to, and I think the statute is 93.640, and we have a recorded interest for the land sale contract purchaser and a recorded interest for the fee holder, title holder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if we did just that, one of the concerns we heard is that, as Lane said, some people haven't recorded. And so what we are trying to do is address that concern by also saying, well, even if it hasn't been recorded, although state law requires that it be recorded, even if it hasn't, as long as it's been notarized, then it would still qualify. And in that later version I was telling you about, in the last sort of 24 hours, the way we have tweaked that language was to say that the owner would mean the current legal owner or owners of fee title of record to property, or if a land sale contract is notarized or is of record.
Mm-hmm.
So it would cover both. It's of record. It doesn't have to be the land sale contract itself. A memorandum recorded would make it of record. So we've tried to cover all of those possibilities.
There was another issue way, way ahead of this, as I recall. It had to do with when the waiver kicks in. And I've probably forgotten what it was right now, but I think the waiver kicked in at the time of the final decision. But if it was not recorded, it seems to me that it should be from when it's recorded. Otherwise, a person could take advantage of non-recording to extend the time of the waiver. But I'll get to that one later on. I'll try to look for some consistency. Why would we want to record these documents?
Any other questions on Section 3 at this point?
Yes, the definition of property, sub 4 on page 5. Should we not also include any interest therein? I think that is the in the main act, or in Measure 37. And you can argue that it's implicit, but I think it's also, I want to make sure that interest less than the fee title could have Measure 37 claims. I think that was the intent of 37.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, this is a change because the work group had decided that trying to deal with all of those interests in property, although is explicit in Measure 37, the work group had reached one of those many compromises that's tied to a whole bunch of other things to say that there would not be a Measure 37 claim, at least a new Measure 37 claim, if all the owner had was an interest in the property. That new Measure 37 claims would be limited to where they were an owner of fee title. So if you don't want to make a change from Measure 37, then this would be a definition that you would want to change to go back to the original Measure 37 language. You would want to have in there or interest therein. We intentionally took it out.
I think I remember from the text of this draft that the phrase any interest therein does pop up occasionally, so I was a little bit confused why it was omitted in the definition, and yet it keeps popping up in the text. I don't know if that's...
Is it the committee's feeling that you want to have any interest thereof added?
Mr. Chair, if I may, just recognizing that it is the committee's choice, any interest therein brings in holders of easements, mortgages, judgments. It is a substantial expansion on that group of people that may be deemed owners in development measure 37. And for the most part, those are not the folks, I believe, who have been harmed by a limitation in use and reduction in value. It's typically going to be your more traditionally consider the owner, and I think that was the sense of the work group in that we don't want easement holders filing claims for property over which all they have is an easement, for instance.
And if I can add, Mr. Chair, this is one of those things that's also connected to another section. In terms of the claims process, one of the requirements is that all owners agree to the filing of a claim. If all owners have to agree, and if anybody who has an interest therein is also an owner, then it would mean before somebody could file a Measure 37 claim, if you go with the process that's spelled out in here, then anybody that's a lien holder, you know, judgment holder, trustee, you know, trustee, bank, all of those people would also have to agree. One of the reasons to have all owners sign is to make sure that that you don't wind up with only one person going forward with a compensation claim and they have a 10% or 50% interest. So that's part of those trade-offs that we were talking about in the work group, and how could we best do this. And the way we drew the line was to say all owners should file, but that wouldn't include somebody who had just an interest in the property.
Again, it's interesting, and I'm using the same word, the definition of interest, as we were sitting here talking about this, I'm thinking 1%, 2%, etc., and that's not the interest you were talking about.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. An interest, owner of a 1% interest in private real property would still be considered an owner under these definitions.
And I think that's the area that we needed to preserve.
We were thinking of other interests other than ownership.
Yes, a 1% share should be preserved, but a mortgage interest shouldn't.
And that's...
And that's essentially the distinction they're making, I think.
Right. That's covered under the present wording.
Under this, yes.
Representative Ackerman, are you okay with that definition?
Yes, I think these lesser interests in land would probably have a hard time showing a compensable loss here anyway. And
any other comments about Section 3 or questions? Okay. Section 4. Glenn, you can give us an overview on this. It looks rather simple, but...
Can I go back to 3 for a moment?
Oh, certainly.
Maybe at the top of page 6, I'm trying to always figure out what does somebody get if the compensable loss as a result of the land use regulation.
Page 6.
Page at the bottom of page 5 and page top of page 6. The owner gets that which was permitted on the date the owner acquired the property, or if not, allow another use of the property permitted on the date the owner acquired the property. Is that consistent with 37? Seems like you're getting two choices here somehow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what's intended by this is, and this again is tied to the claims process, part of the claims process would require the property owner to identify the use of the property that they would like to make of it under the waiver. What Measure 37 says literally is that a government can waive regulations to allow the owner, the current owner of the property, to make a use of it that would have been allowed at the time that they owned it. It doesn't say to allow the owner to make the use that the owner wants to make of it at the time that they acquired it. So the government, at least in theory, can say, well, at the time you acquired your property, you could have used it for a single-family home, and even though you also could have used it as an apartment building, we're not going to give that use to you because Measure 37 says we have to allow you some use that you could have made. That's what existing Measure 37 says. What we tried to do here is to say, no, that we don't think that's right, that the owner should be able to tell us what use they would like to make of it, and if they would have been entitled to do that at the time, then that's the waiver that they would get. What this language does, the first part of paragraph A, the cross-reference back to subsection 5I of section 5, that's where it says that the owner, as part of the claim, has to say what use they want to make of it. So if you say, I want to do an apartment building, then we have to give you that if we can. But what we also wanted to say is, in the event that you're not able to do an apartment building because you really couldn't have, well, we still have to allow you some use that you could have made back then. That's why you have the language at the top of 6. The if not means if you couldn't have done what you specifically asked in your waiver or in your claim to do, we still have to allow you a use. Mm-hmm. So the first half of A says we've got to allow you to do what you asked to do. If we decide you're not entitled to that, we still have to allow you some other use. Okay. That's why it's written the way it is.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. I hope we're trying to avoid a fishing expedition. If I own a piece of property and I say I want to build an apartment building on it, and I think I could have when I acquired the property, but the government says, no, actually, here's the regulation in place on the date you say you acquired it and you weren't allowed to do that. Do I say, well, I'd like to build a fourplex then? And they say, no, you can't. What I would hope to do is make this pretty straightforward. So my question is, do we say that the applicant should identify what they want to, what use they want to make, and they make a complete application that says, I'd like to build an apartment building, but if I can't do that, I want to build this or this? Or do we have this end up with this iteration of sort of a, well, let me see where I can get? You know what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the way this is drafted, you wouldn't have the iteration. The property owner would say in the first instance, here's what I would like to do, because you believe that you could have done it.
Okay.
If the government says, no, in fact, you can't, the regulations that prohibit an apartment complex went into effect before,
right,
but you certainly could have used it as a single-family home. Therefore, we're going to let you do a single-family home. So it's not a back and forth, and with the property owner always suggesting, okay, you didn't let me do what I really wanted to do. Here's my second choice.
And that's why, if I may, we put some onus on the government to say, well, that one's not allowed, but we will give you this, which is more than you could do under current regulation, but closer to what you could have done when you acquired the property. So the onus, essentially, what I'm trying to do is put the onus on the government rather than make the claimant try to find the right answer. Good.
Chair, Representative Nolan, what this avoids too would be a situation where a claimant says, I want to do the apartment, and the government says, no, you can't do the apartment. And then, well, I'd like to do a house, we're going to file a new claim. This allows that to be resolved in the context of a single claim.
Yeah, make the government work.
Isn't this still an extension of Measure 37? I guess I'm still a bit confused on that. As I read it, if you qualify, you get to use a property permitted at the time the owner acquired the property, period. It doesn't say that you get an alternative use. It seems to me we're giving away more here than what 37 allows.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if I may, in practice, we're doing what it says here. I mean, we're having claims come in for large subdivisions, and we're finding that, in fact, under the goals, they couldn't do the one-acre subdivision. We're not sending them back to square one. We're saying that under the goals, you couldn't have done that, but you could do this. So, in truth, I think this really is not an expansion. It's a clarification of what is probably practice already, making clear that it's authorized Because if you took Measure 37 literally by the language, it is, I think, what Glenn suggested, as one making claim decisions, I can have a list on my desk and say, well, that's, okay, I've received this claim. This person, they want a house, they're going to get a cell phone tower instead and give them a cell phone tower. And this person wants a subdivision, I'm going to give them a snack shack. I mean, because all it says is you're permitted a use. It doesn't say that it's the use that you're asking for. So this really is intended to clarify, I think, and will clarify what we're doing in practice.
It says a use permitted at the time the owner acquired the property. That seems to be a fairly simple test. I don't see why it seems to be an expansion to me. That's all I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, there are a number of uses that the property owner could have made at the time that the property owner acquired it. It might have been, if it's exclusive farm use, the statutes identify, 20 or 30 different uses that the property owner could have made, one of them being probably a park. What we were trying to do with this is to recognize what I think is implicit in Measure 37, which is that the government cannot say, well, one of the uses you could have made of your property at the time you acquired it was open space. So we're going to waive the regulations and allow you to have open space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a court is going to accept that. And what we're trying to do with this is to make it clear that if there was any government that wanted to do that, that they couldn't. Is that an expansion of the existing measure? It depends on how you interpret the existing measure. Personally, I don't think this is an expansion, other than it's putting the onus on the government to at least listen to what the property owner would like to do with their property. And if the property owner could have done that at the time they acquired it, then allow them to do that. If they couldn't have done that, you still have to allow them some other use. You can't just say, nope, couldn't have done that, claim denied.
And the way this was written, the second part of it, or if not, allow another use on the property permitted. And you're telling me now that it's you can get another use on the property even though it may not have been permitted when the owner acquired the property. That seems to me a reasonable reading and a vast expansion of the Measure 37.
This is intended to say that you could do any other use even if not allowed at the time you acquired it. This is still limited to something you could have done at the time that you acquired the property.
Okay.
I'm sorry I had to step out of the room. I'd like to go backwards and ask you a question on 2, if I may. The original Measure 37 and the definition of any statute regulating use of land interest therein, I'm sorry, land use regulation shall include, and it gives five categories of that, I through V category. This section 2 lists 10 categories of definition. Is this just a simple explication of what's in one of those five, or does it add anything to one of those five?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, it depends on how the courts would ultimately interpret the existing definition, those five. For example,
it actually doesn't depend on that. I mean, we're putting statute together here.
Well,
whether it expands or not depends on how a court might interpret.
And let me give you an example. In old Measure 37, it says in paragraph C that land use regulation includes local government comprehensive plans, zoning ordinances, land division ordinances, and transportation ordinances.
Right.
That's what a city, for example, would be subject to in terms of what's the land use regulation covered by Measure 37. I have said at a number of different conferences that, in my opinion, that would not include big portions of zoning codes or land use codes, because large portions of land use codes are not local government comprehensive plans, they're not zoning ordinances, they're not land division ordinances, and they're not transportation ordinances.
Right.
Others have disagreed with me. I don't know how a court is going to decide, so I'm not quite sure what that means. What we intended to do with this is to clarify that. And at the top of page 5, the 2A, a land use regulation is defined in ORS 197.015. That would include everything in a city's land use code. And so if the drafters, if the courts interpreted Measure 37 as the drafters apparently intended, which is to incorporate all sections of a land use code, then the new 2A would not be an expansion. If the courts, on the other hand, interpreted old Measure 37 in my, the way I view it, then 2A would be an expansion.
I mean, our job is not to presage what the courts are going to do. I mean, if we're trying to simply do an explication, a clarification, then I would like to know which of those 10 uses include other than a local government comprehensive plan, a zoning ordinance, a land division ordinance, and a transportation ordinance. And my argument would be we shouldn't be putting them in if they're not included in that. Or if we do, we should do it explicitly. Say, okay, we're expanding it. But so it seems important to me to know which of those A through J things are not straightforward interpretations of the five under Measure 37. It would be very helpful if you could tell us which ones are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, this might be another time to give me until Monday to give you something that says, here's a comparison side by side.
Excellent. That'd be very helpful. Thank you, sir.
Section 4. Committee, it would be our intent today to maybe take about another hour, if we can today, get through the dash threes, and then on Monday we will go through the other amendments that we have, the sevens and the sixes, and do the same process of application. And then we will have something that we can actually say we're building on. So, okay, if we can move on to...
We covered 5 out of 35 pages in 3, so...
Yeah, but it gets easier as we go on. Right. Okay, Section 4.
Mr. Chair, if you want to make some very quick progress,
Glenn, hang on just one second. Dave Honeycutt has been sitting in the back of the room, and I apologize because he probably should be up here in one of these chairs being grilled as well as our other two guests. So, afford to lose too much more hair.
Yeah. Sure you can.
You're laughing too. Just one point.
Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon International. To speak to Representative Greenick's last question about the definition of land use regulation, the change here, I think, is a significant narrowing of the existing Measure 37. The existing Measure 37 has the initial provision defines a land use regulation as any statute that regulates the use of land. That's very broad. This provision, although it contains more sections, specifies different statutes and then says anything else that's not and anything else that's not mentioned here is excluded. So this is the opt-in, opt-out argument or discussion that we've had in our in the working group that occupied a fair amount of time.
And Mr. Chair, what we get you on Monday will be something that hopefully Dave and I both will say we agree on what the change means, and that's what we'll try to do.
Do you feel we're spinning our wheels by going through this now, or do you feel that it would be advantageous to wait until Monday? I don't think the committee has a lot of work in front of it that it wants to, you know, repeat going through all this with your changes.
Mr. Chair, my view is that I can take you through significant volume of this.
Okay.
If I skip certain sections and we come back to those, because I think there are some sections here that we can say shouldn't be controversial, that we all would agree, you know, please adopt it as we presented it. It's clarifications or it's, you know, judicial review and claims process. And so what I would do then is to skip section 4, come back to that, go to section 5, which is the beginning of claims process, and sections 5 and 6 spell out the claims process, what people would need to file as part of their claim, the notice that would need to be provided by the government, and to whom, how people would have an opportunity to submit information, whether by public hearing or by written comment, what the government would need to do in terms of making a decision, how quickly the decision would have to be made, and those sorts of provisions. And I took, I think, a significant amount of time 2 days ago walking through those provisions. I can certainly talk about, or any of us can talk about, some of the details if you would like, but those are sections I think that we would commend to you that you do incorporate into your new bill, as well as the judicial review provisions. We did spend, as the work group, a significant amount of time trying to come up with a process that we all thought was fair, that we thought would not disadvantage either the property owner, the neighbors, or the governments, a judicial review process that wouldn't result in litigation over how you're supposed to litigate. And so that's what the intent of those sections were. And that would be true.
A simple question I'd like to ask you. Does this subsection 4, the bottom of page 8, deal with the question about whether somebody needs to file a claim against both a local and against the state? I know that's the one that's caused a lot of trouble. Is that taken care of here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, the way, and this takes it back, unfortunately, to section 4, what we have said in section 4 is that a claim must be filed with the entity that enacted the regulation. Under existing Measure 37, a claimant can file a claim with the government that either enforces or enacts, which puts a local government possibly in the position of having a claim that relying on a regulation that the state enacted that we don't have the authority to, as a local government, to waive. What this says is, as a property owner, you will need to file a claim. If you're outside the urban growth boundaries, you will really need to file your claim, one with the county and the second one with the state. And both the counties and the state would continue to encourage property owners who filed with them to also file with the other.
That's the separation of powers issue that we can answer on this.
I mean, why should that have to happen? That doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think what that does is, as much as anything, respects the jurisdictional authority. I'm not sure that it's necessarily a constitutional separation of powers issue, but for instance, when the legislature adopts the statute, the intent is to establish some statewide policy, I think it's a questionable public policy from my mind as to whether we want to empower every local government in the state to adopt or waive that statutory enactment, for instance, and by the same token it goes both ways. Whether local governments want to give the state the authority to enforce or waive local ordinances. I think the cleanest way is to recognize the jurisdictional boundaries between state and local.
So to me, that's something we need to pay attention to, because I mean, the current claim is that a county has passed a local ordinance as a result of some state land use planning, some goal or something else, and now the claimant has to go both to the county and to the state, and we ought to at least talk about that.
Mr. Again, Representative Greenwood, part of the reason, again, for recognizing both is that you have local ordinances enacted in compliance with state statute, and in fact, statute the statute may apply directly to the land. So if you take the local ordinance away, you still have the statute applicable to the property. It's still there and still in force unless it's waived.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I was instructed to keep moving. If that doesn't mean that I should be slowing you down.
I have a question. On the same theme, suppose that you must join file a claim against both entities, state and local, and you only do one. And you do qualify under filing just against one to get your waiver, even though you should have filed against the state.
We're all looking, Vice Chair Green, like Representative Ackerman, we're all looking a little puzzled. I'm not sure.
Okay, all right. You have a claim that should be filed both against the state and the county.
Right.
You only file against the county.
And they waive.
And they must waive. Do I get my waiver, or is there some defense here because I didn't also join the state or file with the state?
Under the Vice Chair Green and Representative Ackerman, under the existing measure or under the proposal in front of us?
Either way, because I don't know the answer.
Well, under the existing measure, I think the question, and this is a question of land use law, and this particular provision of Chapter 197 that's in existence, the question becomes whether or not if the local government has adopted, as they're required to do, the language of an administrative rule or goal, one of the commission's administrative rules or goals, whether that administrative rule or goal continues to apply to the local government's land use decisions. If the answer is no, then arguably, once the local government waives that provision, the provision in its zoning ordinance and comprehensive plan, then the property owner is free to make use of their land. Those particular provisions of Chapter 197 have been interpreted by the courts to not allow local governments to say that the statutes are never subsumed by a local government zoning ordinance or comprehensive plan. So if it's a statutory provision that trips you up and you file a claim only with the local government, get a waiver of the local government zoning ordinance provisions, and arguably at that, you wouldn't get a waiver of the administrative rules, it simply wouldn't be applicable. But if there was a statutory provision that continued, a statutory provision that you didn't file a claim with the state to waive, then there would be no waiver of that statutory provision. And you'd still be bound by that unless and until you filed a subsequent claim with the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The issue here is essentially we want to take up the question of whether somebody needs to file both with the county and with the state for the same provision. One is applied by the county and the other. And it seems to me this version says they still need to file both, but we really need to talk about that.
Now's the time to do it. The committee's assuming that the three of you are basically in agreement on the document that we have in front of us.
On page six.
Today. This hour.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that this state and local reflects, I think, what is currently recognized best practice. I know Oregon is in action has recommended this from day one, as has the State Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities. That's not a controversial element, I think, of the claims process.
Yeah, Chair Gerard, Representative Greenleaf, we've recommended that you file your claim with both the state and the local government, even if you're not sure, or else you run into the problem that that Representative Ackerman was talking about, and some uncertainty as to what it is, whether or not everything that you need to get waived in order to use your property has been waived. I agree it's not the cleanest process, but as long as you've got regulations adopted at both the state and local levels, that's the only option.
Was there an option considered that would simplify that?
Are there any other?
Okay. Sure, Broward. I don't. It would be our opinion, and I'm hoping I see some head nods to the left. It would be our opinion that you wouldn't want to give the state the decision-making authority to determine whether to waive local regulations, nor would you want to give the local government the authority for that particular jurisdiction to waive LCDC rules or state statutes. The agency that adopted the administrative rule ought to have the ultimate authority to determine how to proceed with that. The local jurisdiction that adopted the local ordinance ought to have the ultimate decision-making power on how to proceed with that. And for statutory provisions, we would argue for a delegation to the particular agency that handles, that enforces those statutory provisions, and give them the ability to make the determinations to the statutory proceedings. Although it's not as easy on the property owner as we would like, probably the source of some of Representative Greenlick's complaints, I think that's the best way for the government folks to handle things.
Are not the people more protected?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the property owners are better protected by getting waivers from state and local. There's no question about that. And I think to go beyond that, you would be wading into significant other aspects of the land use statutes, I think, probably to make changes that would somehow bring the local and state regulation together like that. Recognizing this is imposed on an existing land use program, this is the best way to do it, not just for government, but it is really for the protection of the landowner, so they know they've got the cleanest bill of health when they're done.
And that is our prime purpose, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I was going to just remark on perhaps a suggestion that this is an analogy that occurs when we make civil rights filings. We file a claim with Boley. It's also deemed to be a filing of the federal charge with the EEOC in Seattle. So my point is that you could say if you file with the county, it's also deemed to be filed with the state. Of course, it takes some administrative work to file that claim or transmit that claim up to the state, but at least the person's rights would be protected with respect to the running of timelines, and then try to flesh out the claim later. So throwing that out as a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what I believe. Although now I feel comforted because all I got a complaint, I'll just tell him Honeycutt said it's the right way to do it, and they thought to him about it. But, I mean, it absolutely seems to me the state assigns the local government to do some things as a part of a state regulation, a state goal or something. It seems to me once that we ought to find a way for that person just to file that claim with the local government, and for the local government to say, well, okay, we'll act on it, we'll also forward it to the state, we'll let you know, we'll manage the process, because it seems to me, it just doesn't make sense to me to say, well, there are two or three things here, you have to file it with three different places. I mean, it's just
Mr. Chair, we had an agreement. Actually, we tried that. I think it was probably about 4 months ago. A unified filing process. And you ran into things that created new layers of complexity. For one, who's got is the county or city the portal for filing? Now, they've got responsibility to forward that claim. It's their responsibility now to forward that claim to the state. How does that work within the 180-day timeline for response? Do you have two different timelines going now for the same claim? And then there's the issue of fees, where local governments are charging fees, and if the state is going to be authorized a fee under this statute, you've got essentially then local government potentially receiving and then having to remit a fee to a state and being responsible for that, or vice versa. And I'm trying to think what other complications, but we actually tried to diagram that out and drafted it once or twice, and it got. Actually, this is simpler, believe it or not.
Representative, Chair Gerard, a comment to the committee, if I may. This, what we're hearing, is consistent with and the very same verbiage we heard as early as
the first time Mr. Shadowley was here. He advised claimants to file claims at every level that might be a land use law that will prohibit them from using their land. And that was in, could have been late January.
I'm sure it was. So I think what we're getting is a nice try, Mitch.
Well, I mean, I understand him saying that in January. We didn't know what we were doing. But hearing that, well, this is a little complicated for the governments to do it this way, so we'd rather complicate the right of the applicant in order to make sure they have everything. It still doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me, if there are two independent things, if there's a state statute and independently a local ordinance about that same piece of land, then it makes sense to me. But mostly what we're talking about is state statutes or rules that the local government enacts. Local is responsible for enacting local ordinances or local plans or local comprehensive plans about in aid to that. And it seems to me that ought to be a linked claim. If they're really separate, if there's a forest regulation on my land and a local zoning regulation, and they're really different, and they don't relate to each other, that might take two claims, I understand. But if it's, you've got a comprehensive plan, and that comprehensive plan's in place, and it's in place in aid of state statutes, and you've approved that comprehensive plan in LCDC, then I think the county ought to be able to waive. Or they ought to say, no, we can't do this. This needs to go to the state, we're forward to the state for action. But two applications just doesn't make sense.
Mr. Chair, if I can address that, one of the other pieces that Lane left out that goes right to what you just said is there are differences. There are significant differences in terms of what the goals, statewide planning goals, might require local governments to do, and then what the local governments do in response to that. That when somebody files a claim, there may be some state statutes or state administrative rules that need to be waived, and there may be some very different county regulations, some of which are implementing those, but there may also be some other ones on top of those. And the difficulty, one of the other difficulties we had is, okay, how do we identify when the property owner would file in one spot? Okay, you just have to file with the county for this one because the county would then forward. And when would the property owner have to file in two because they're really concerned or they need to be concerned about the Forest Practices Act in addition to county zoning code? And we couldn't come up with something that was simple from the property owner's perspective, and so we thought what would be simpler is to just have a black and white rule that says if you're outside the county, or if you're outside the urban growth boundary, if you're outside the urban growth boundary, file in both. That's simple. Now, it may be that
inside the urban growth boundary, only in one?
Well, if you're inside the urban growth boundary, it's unlikely that you'll need to file with the state because, particularly if you're inside of city limits, because there are, I mean, we haven't been able to come up with one yet, state regulation that would need to be waived as part of a city regulation. Generally, well, almost exclusively, when cities have adopted comprehensive plans and land use codes, the state statutes fall away. So if somebody has something that needs to be waived inside the city for use, they can file the one claim with the city, and odds are very high that that's all they need to do in order to get that use. When you're outside the city limits, that's when there's still state statutes overlaid and directly applicable at times to the county land use process.
Question on the 180 days. If the county progresses with a claim and then has to refer to the state, the clock is ticking from the original county acceptance of the claim, correct? In other words,
Mr. Chair, that was part of what hung us up. We took a few runs at that. I don't remember how we addressed that, Glenn. Did we add 15 or 30 days or something for the receiving jurisdiction to respond?
We tried to deal with that as we were trying to work out that kind of sort of combined process, filing one and then refer to the other, and there were just too many other issues that we couldn't figure out how to make it simple. The way this is written is you file your claim with the county, and the 180 days begins to run for that process when you file with the county, and you file your claim with the state, and the separate 180 days begins to run for that. What we then tried to do in the judicial review provision is to say, even though you have two separate claims going on, perhaps slightly different time tracks, that if there are any challenges to those decisions, that those should then get married up when they get to circuit court so that you don't have two separate pieces of litigation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I brought up a question. You said you have to file with the county when 180 days starts. Is it when the county deems it complete? The 180 days starts, or when you filed the claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe it's deemed. Dave, do you remember the land use process? Because it's the same as the existing process.
Then it's when they deem it complete.
No, it's not. I don't think it's the same. Chair Garrard, Representative Smith, the 180 days would begin, I believe, when the application is submitted. A notice would go out by the local government or the state if it was a state claim, and this is on this is section 5 sub 7, starts on page 9 of the bill. And the public entity would notify the property owner within 30 days of if the claim was incomplete, and the property owner would then have the opportunity to either submit the missing information, say that they're not going to submit the missing information, or give some the missing information and say, I'm not going to submit anything on the rest. I believe that, the claim is complete when the claim is received, I believe, is the...
It's not...
Right.
Can you tell me where it
Correct.
Says that?
That's sub 8 on page 10. Oh, that's if the public entity does not notify an owner.
Right.
If the public entity notifies the owner, the claim would be complete when the public entity received the fee and either the missing information or a letter from the landowner saying I'm not submitting anything more, or a letter from the landowner saying I'm submitting part of the things that you asked for and but not the rest. Please consider my claim complete and press forward.
Follow up. And just a comment, I'm already having a problem with a landowner in Montgomery County that can't get a complete application. So are you saying their claim has started or it has not started?
Chair Garrard, Representative Smith, under the existing Measure 37, there are a minority, and I think this is a pretty small minority of jurisdictions that believe, and Multnomah County being one of them, that believe that they have the authority under the measure to determine when a claim is complete or not complete. I think for purposes of utilizing their local government process that they've created, they can probably make that determination of when a claim is complete for purposes of using their ordinance. However, if you recall, under the existing Measure 37, if at the end of 180 days after submitting a claim, you are not satisfied with whatever has happened, or maybe nothing has happened, you have a cause of action and then can proceed into circuit court. We were trying, one of the things that this process does is one of the puts and takes, this creates, for lack of a better term, a rightness requirement where the property owner would have to submit a claim and utilize the local government process. 99 times out of 100 on the existing Measure 37, that's the wise way to go anyway. We advise people, if you can utilize the local government process, by all means do so. It beats the heck out of finding yourself in the middle of a lawsuit. I'm sure that the local government folks would support that as well. This resolves that, specifies exactly how to file the claim,
where to file it, what the timelines are, and ultimately doesn't give, puts the control of the timing of the completeness of the claim in the hands of the property owner.
So in your opinion, by adopting this section and applying it uniformly across the state, we will eliminate certain counties from using any kind of delay tactics in commencing the 180-day clock.
Mr. Chair, not to cast any stones at any counties, but I'd say what I would say is that this measure specifies with complete uniformity and specificity what you need to do to file a claim, to make that claim complete, and to have that claim processed.
Absolutely. In your opinion, is there any wordage that we could add to make that more explicit?
Mr. Chair, I don't think you, and maybe one of the other two gentlemen would like to address this, I don't think you need to.
Mr. Chair, I agree. I don't think you need to, and to go back to Representative Smith's, the constituent you had, the way this is drafted, what a city, county, or the state could do when they receive the claim, within 30 days, they have to identify whether there's any missing information. What the property owner then has the right to do is send in a letter saying, I disagree, I don't think there's anything missing. When that letter goes in, the 180-day clock starts. There's no ambiguity whatsoever in this. I mean, so when Dave said this is in the hands or control of the property owner, I think that's what he was referring to. All the property owner has to do in response to a letter saying incomplete application is to send a letter back saying it's complete. And then that 180 days does begin to run the way this is drafted. And that's at the top of page 10.
May I add some clarification?
Sure.
I heard people also say, we're not paying the fee. We're not giving you any information. We'll just wait the 180 days and take it to court. Is that under this, if I send, as the Cook County Commissioner said, I send my claim on the back of a cocktail napkin. I have land in this thing. I've had it this long. I want to waive all regulations since 1968. And you come back and say, well, you need to file an application, you need to do this and that, you need to submit a $750 fee. And I say, I want to submit a $750 fee, and I'm giving you all I'm going to give you. What happens at the end of 6 months from that period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, a couple things. First, if the way this is written,
under this, yes.
If you fail to submit the fee, then your application is not complete. You don't get to send in a letter that says, I'm not giving you the fee. I mean, that's a black and white. There's no question as to whether you paid the fee or not. So the way this is drafted, you have to pay the fee and send a letter that says, I'm not giving you any other information.
If I haven't paid the fee... If you pay the fee, then after 180 days, I cannot take it to court under this.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct. That's correct. But if you paid the fee and you submitted your napkin,
With the $750 check,
right? Then the government said your application's incomplete, and you send a letter back saying you've got all you're going to get. This would require the government to make a decision. The decision is going to be to deny the claim because you haven't, as the property owner, submitted information that would allow us to conclude that you're entitled to a waiver. When it goes up to court, the way this is drafted, and this is in the judicial review provisions, the court proceeding is based on the record before the government. So if you didn't give the government the information that the judge would need to conclude that you had a valid claim, you're not going to be able to give that to the government.
All they would have would be my cocktail napkin.
That's right. Correct.
That's very interesting.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Follow-up clarification. How about the appraisals? Because Montgomery County is requiring this landowner to provide not only the fee, but two certified appraisals before they're done this complete.
Mr. Chair.
Doesn't want to spend thousands of dollars.
Representative Smith, this would not require any property owner to submit an appraisal, and it would not allow any government
to say, wait a minute, your application, we're not going to process your application because you haven't submitted an appraisal. It would be the same if the government said, you need to give us an appraisal. And this, by the way, doesn't say that an appraisal is required as part of the claim, but if the government said, you need to give us an appraisal, you could send back a letter that says, you have all you're going to get, and the 180 days starts to run, and the government would have to process that claim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the criteria for a filing for the claim that the property owner has to submit are contained on page 9 of the bill in sub 5 of section 5. That lists out the criteria 5A through I. So much of our work as a work group seems to be directed towards the opposite ends of the spectrum, the cocktail napkin mischief, or the two, you've got to submit two appraisals and give up your firstborn mischief on the other side.
Oh, you mean second.
Yeah, secondborn, there you go. And so I believe that the claims process that is contained here really is a step in the right direction as far as resolving those issues, resolving the mischief possibilities on either end.
Gentlemen, we know you've been living all of these same questions for the past 7 months. I hope and I deeply appreciate the patience you show with our questions, because for us this is really the first time in a lot of close detail. So we appreciate your understanding of our questions and the patience that you're showing with this committee.
May I ask you another question? No. That's your patience.
No, you can't. Oh, okay. Of course you can.
I'm really interested in this appraisal question because I imagine the scenario that I say, give us an appraisal, maybe not two certified appraisals, but get us an appraisal, make a claim on compensation. You say, no, I'm not going to give you an appraisal. And the county says, fine, we'll compensate you. We estimate your damages to be $1. And we'll send you a check. The information that then goes to court is only the information that's been put in the record at that point. So if I want to compensate you $1 and you haven't filed an appraisal and it goes to court, then there's no basis, it seems to me, in the record for arguing whether the dollar was the proper claim, was a proper compensation or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, when I said that what the court does is to make its decision based on the record, there's one exception to that, the way this is written. When the case first goes up to the judge, the question before the judge is whether the government, in essence, properly decided that a claim is valid or not. Once the judge makes that decision, and if the decision is that the government improperly decided it wasn't a valid claim, or improperly decided the amount of the compensation, at that point the government has a choice. The government can decide to waive the regulations that the court has decided needed to be waived, or the government gives notice to the court that it wants to compensate. If it gives the notice that it wants to compensate, then the government has 90 days to go out and get an appraisal, because the government may not have gotten an appraisal either yet. So the government gets its appraisal. The government then provides that appraisal to the property owner, and the property owner says, I can live with that number or I can't. If the property owner says that he or she cannot live with that number, then the property owner gets to go get his or her own appraisal. And then the government and the property owner talk to see whether they can reach agreement. If they can't reach agreement, then the issue goes back to the judge, and now the judge gets to take live testimony, gets to look at the appraisals, gets to
hear from the appraisers.
Right.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the evidence in the record. What we do, while we don't require an appraisal, there is a requirement, I believe it's, yeah, it's subsection H, mm-hmm. evidence H, excuse me, of sub 5H on page 9, mm-hmm. evidence that the land use regulations identified in paragraph F of this subsection have reduced the fair market value of the property. While that need not take into, while that need not include an appraisal, some type of evidentiary showing that there's been a reduction in value is required. And in many cases, I don't think there's not going to be a dispute over whether a regulation has limited value, particularly when you're talking in rural areas. That's going to be an easy call, I think, and you can. Wayne can speak to this, but I think that so far, at least with the claims filed to date, that's been a pretty easy call one way or the other.
Well, my cocktail napkin wouldn't have anything about this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, if a property owner submits an application on a cocktail napkin, they will lose. I don't think there's any way to... If a property owner submits an application on a cocktail napkin under the existing Measure 37, although it's not as clear that they would lose as it is under this, I still think they'll lose. But this is designed to solve the mischief on either end.
Okay, let's move on to the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative
Smith. Two suggestions might be to add language in that on the... I've got to get my glasses. One was not to exceed the 30-day notice was maybe on or before 30 days because in Mormon account they wait to exactly 30 days and send it to you in the mail so you get it.
Oh, don't pick on Mormon
account. I'm not. But that's what I hear a lot from. And those are the people that voted for this. And that's part of the frustration, is that it doesn't get deemed complete or noticed. The other thing was the added language part I started to talk about was the regulations. If they don't list the actual regulation, shouldn't there be some language to pertain to the government has to come back and say what the regulations are or give the opportunity to address that issue? That cannot be.
Yeah, Representative Smith, we have tried to deal with that as well. On page 9, one of the requirements, it's paragraph F, says the claim should include a list or a description, and those words were chosen carefully. We added description so that it doesn't have to be this administrative rule, that statute. It's, you know, you can describe the regulations, and if you get down to the third line of that paragraph, it then says, or a description of the specific use of the property that the owner wishes to carry out. And what's intended there is to allow the owner to say, I'm not sure what regulations, what statewide planning rules are preventing me from building a house, but I want to build a house.
Okay.
And then it's up to the government to say, okay, you want to build a house, here are the regulations.
Okay. Answering
my
question. Thank you.
And I think that's the way BLCD is currently dealing with it.
It is, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. Someone might file a claim that says EFU 40. Now, that's not a regulation, but it tells us what we need to know in order to evaluate the claim. And so we're already doing that. Sometimes it will be just, again, this is reflecting almost what is practice. So most of our claimants are not represented by attorneys, and their statement may be, I can't build a house. And we don't need to have them cite that rule or go to us. We know what it is if we know where the property is. And so this is working, this language is working for us.
I think we heard testimony the other night that it wasn't working, that they were denying claims because they weren't specifically addressing which regulation.
Not from the state.
Not from the state, okay. Okay, thank you.
We'll move to Section 6.
Section 6 is part of that claims process. The claim is now complete, and what Section 6 does is to say the government has to give notice to adjacent property owners, to other governmental entities that also have regulations that may apply to that property.
specifies that the notice, in addition to describing the claim, needs to state whether a public hearing is going to be held. There's no requirement that a public hearing be held, but if there's going to be one, the notice has to state the time and date and location of the hearing. If there isn't going to be a public hearing, then the government has to provide an opportunity for public comment, and the notice has to say when that comment is due and where it has to be sent. And there's some other things that the notice would also contain. Provides that, you know, at the close of the record, that the public entity has to make a decision, and that the decision can be compensation, waiver, or denial.
Any questions on Section 6? We'll move on to Section 7.
Mr. Chair, Section 7 is a provision that would allow, and this would be optional at the property owner's discretion, would allow the property owner to submit both a land use application and a Measure 37 claim simultaneously. That would give the government a little more information about what the property owner really wants to do, which would enable the government to say, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and waive those regulations to allow you to do exactly what you want. If the land use application and Measure 37 claim are submitted together, then the timelines for processing the land use application are put on hold while the Measure 37 claim gets decided. Once it's decided, if the decision is to grant a waiver, then that waiver becomes part of the criteria that the government would use for making a decision on the land use application. Again, it's entirely discretionary, the property owner's their decision.
Any questions on Section 7, Representative Atkins?
But then there's a different appeal process for LUBA, is there not, under Section 7?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, that's correct. If a waiver is granted, then there isn't any immediate judicial review of that waiver. Instead, any review of the correctness of granting that waiver becomes part of any subsequent LUBA proceeding.
That would almost commit the landowner to asking for the waiver rather than compensation, then, wouldn't it?
Not going to grant compensation, is it?
Well, I think that is correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman. This presumes that what the owner wants to do is actually undertake a use. That would be the point of the land use application, right? So they would be making that decision on the front end.
Okay, any further questions?
Just one.
Representative?
Just a general question. Why are we doing Section 7 at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we asked ourselves that question as we were going through there, but it's at the option of the property owner, and the property owner, because of the 180-day time frame, right, in the Measure 37 in the claims process, followed by a subsequent land use application. Once you know the provisions that are being waived, you can the two ways to do it. You can either do the 37 claims process first, may take you 180 days, and you may walk out of there, assuming you can prove that you've got a valid claim, with a decision by the local and the state government saying, we are waiving the following provisions, X, Y, and Z. You can then go in and submit a subsequent land use application, saying, okay, now that I've gotten the waiver of provisions X, Y, and Z, I'm here to build my house, and during the course of that, nobody can consider X, Y, and Z because they've been waived, but that takes that gets you into the land use application process, which again then can conceivably take either 120 or 150 days at the local level, depending on whether you're inside or outside of your growth boundary. A property owner may not wish to do that. They may wish to do, for lack of a better term, one-stop shopping, and submit their land use application simultaneously with their Measure 37 claim. That was the purpose of Subsection 7. It was a fairly difficult draft, and we were able to think it through quite a bit, but it's an option for the property owner, and some property owners may choose to try and take advantage of it and get it all done at one time, and if they want to do that, we thought that would be a good choice for them. It's not a requirement.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couldn't they do that now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, under Measure 37?
No, without, I mean, anybody can go and file a land use application and pay a fee. Can't you do that now?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the way statutes are currently drafted, it wouldn't play out the same way. And the reason it wouldn't is for this reason. State statutes say that the criteria in effect at the time that a land use application is filed must govern that application.
Okay.
So what would happen is if the property owner, without this provision, if the property owner filed an application, land use application today, and also filed a Measure 37 claim today, the government under that other state statute would be required to ignore the Measure 37 claim, even if it's a valid claim, but will be required to ignore it under that other state statute, process that land use application under the other state, well, under the criteria in effect, and most likely wind up denying the application because we're assuming that the reason they're filing a Measure 37 claim is that they need some provision waived. So without this, that other state statute says, government, even though you may know when you see that Measure 37 claim, you're going to wind up granting it 30 or 60 or 180 days down the road, we're going to need to deny this land use application. And that means, you know, the property owner's not going to be happy, the government's not going to be happy, the property owner is going to come back at a later time and file probably a second application, so it costs more money for everybody.
Thank you.
But it is true that the Measure 37 waiver doesn't automatically make the land use application. I mean, I can now ask the right to build a shopping center that I couldn't have, and they say, okay, you can ask to build a shopping center, but now my application for the shopping center needs to meet all the criteria that a shopping center application would need to meet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what we're finding in as claims play out, that really the function of a Measure 37 claim is to determine what law applies to the use that you intend. That is, I've described it in another context as land use time zones. I mean, you file your Measure 37 claim, a determination is made first as to whether the claim is valid. If it's valid, then based on the date of acquisition of ownership, it's determined that the law of, and you name the year, is the law that applies to your use of the property. That then determines, the process then reverts to the land use process where you file an application to actually undertake that use. And that land use application is then reviewed under the law applicable to the year that the person acquired the property.
So building the shopping center, let's talk about that. In 1970, when I bought the land, I could have built the shopping center, and there were a set of design and other things that controlled the building of the shopping center. I can't ask to build a shopping center now, so I do a Measure 37 claim. It says, okay, we'll waive it. You could have asked to build a shopping center in 1970. You can ask to build a shopping center. I now produce my land use application to build a shopping center. Which are the criteria that now apply to the design, the regulations around the shopping center? I mean, you're certainly not saying it's back to 1970 on that one, now that I have the land use.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwich, it's going to be a combination. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's going to be a combination is because under Measure 37, whether it's the existing Measure 37 or what we have proposed, there are only certain types of regulations that the government has authority to waive. If it's a regulation that didn't restrict the use, if it's a regulation that didn't reduce the value, if it's a regulation that falls within one of the exemptions, for example, a public health or safety regulation, those cannot be waived. And so it may be that there are certain regulations, for example, the zoning. The zoning back then would have allowed you to do a shopping center, and today the zoning wouldn't. Okay, so we waive the zoning, but that doesn't mean you get to do a shopping center today, because it could be that our current regulations related to transportation access, you know, the amount that safely can go on that road wouldn't allow you to do a shopping center. So you get your waiver, you then apply for your shopping center, and the government will review that based on, in essence, the zoning from 1970, and the other regulations like transportation access control.
Building codes.
Building codes for us today.
Current building codes.
Yes, current building codes. And building codes
are common. Things and stuff like that.
And building codes is a better example because there are some transportation provisions that are not public health or safety, and there are some that are. But building codes is a great example. It would be the current building code.
You wouldn't get to build a 1970 shopping center.
But you could build a 2005 shopping center.
You could. If, yes, a waiver of a zoning restriction.
Yeah. When you ask a question and the two of them look at each other, the three of them and smile, you know you're in trouble.
I'm never in trouble when Wayne smiles at me.
We'll try and finish up with section 7.
Chair the revenue committee.
And start with section 8 on Monday. So, Mr. Gallagher has asked permission to address the committee in regards to commercial development.
Can you vote on whether Gallagher gets to talk to us or not?
Correct. That's when you and Mr. Chandler. That's, okay. Do we have any further questions on section 7? We got 10 minutes or so more. Let's try and finish up with 8. And then I know that's another section that I think we're pretty much all in agreement on. Except for Representative Appleton.
No, I would just try and...
I'll have maybe 3 questions on 8.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of juicing this, I would suggest that you lump sections 8 through 11 because they all relate to judicial review.
Okay.
It's just sort of the beginning of the process, filing the claim all the way through any possible appeal up to the Court of Appeals.
Then we'll start there on Monday.
Okay. Good.
Any last questions, committee? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I think all now have an idea, a sample of how we're going to try and get through this.
Mr. Chair, just put on the record, read an article today in the Statesman Journal about one of the first, if not the first, Measure 37 approval in Marion County, right near Salem. The people were actually quite elated, but they had a caveat there in the end of the article that the gentleman said, "I certainly hope that the legislature doesn't do anything to mess this up." He was concerned that whatever we do within this room is going to cause him to lose his ability that he has been approved to build now. I'd really like to have some assurance that we are not inadvertently going to harm someone who has already been made whole. I think we ought to be really looking at that situation as we move along.
Probably do it intentionally rather than.
Well, that's a very good point.
Well, somebody taking care of
representative. So, we have to keep that in mind as we go through.
Yes, sir.
So keep reminding us. Committee, you have your materials. Monday we will convene at 1:15 thereabouts. We will. We don't know if we'll have an afternoon session or not, but if we do have an afternoon session, we will reconvene in the evening, on Monday evening, and you've got the sample of how we're going to try and get through this and do this, and I hope you have a good weekend, because Monday and Tuesday
Tuesday the plans are for potentially 3 meetings. The first one at 8:30, and then a recess from 1:15, and then a recess, and if needed, a 6 p.m. meeting. Not in this room, it will be in hearing room D.
Tuesday, that would be Tuesday.
Well, that would be on Sunday.
And Monday evening is only if we don't have.
If we don't have an afternoon session, we will be able to work through and hopefully won't need. But again, it all depends.
We're moving the
We don't have to be floor session.
No.
We have to keep working.
We'll keep working through on this. I'm very encouraged by what we accomplished today. So, House Committee on Land Uses adjourned.
You know,